From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is founder and president of the Waterkeeper Alliance, an organization of nearly 300 waterkeepers spanning the globe. He serves as chief prosecuting attorney for the Hudson River Keeper. He is a clinical professor and supervising attorney at Pace University School of Law's Environmental Litigation Clinic, and he is co-host of Ring of Fire on Air America Radio. He is with us in Wilmington today as the Waterkeeper Alliance hosts its annual convention here. Robert Kennedy Jr., welcome to Coastline.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have questions for Mr. Kennedy, you can email them to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us today at @CoastlineHQR. We'll open the phone lines a little bit later in the program. Robert Kennedy, your journey as a champion of clean waterways began on the Hudson River. And for that work, you were named one of Time Magazine's Heroes of the Planet. You've held that up as an international model for ecosystem protection. And how is it that? What changes were you able to make in New York that changed the health?
It wasn't really me. It was I kind of jumped on a moving train. The organization, which at that point was called the Hudson River Fishermen's Association, later became Riverkeeper, and then, you know, it's evolved into the Waterkeeper Alliance. But the movement was started on the Hudson River by a blue-collar coalition of commercial and recreational fishermen who mobilized back in 1966 to reclaim the Hudson from its polluters. We have on the Hudson River the oldest commercial fishery in North America. It's like North Carolina. It's 350 years old. Many of the people I represent come from families that have been fishing the river continuously since Dutch colonial times. It's a traditional gear, sustainable fishery. They use the same fishing methods that were taught by the Algonquin Indians to the original Dutch settlers of New Amsterdam and then passed down through the generations. And one of the enclaves of that fishery was a little village called Grotonville, New York, that's 30 miles north of New York City on the east bank of the river. The people who lived there in the 1960s were not your prototypical kind of affluent environmentalists. They were factory workers, carpenters, lathers, electricians. Half the people in Grotonville made their living, or at least some part of it, grabbing or fishing the Hudson. These were people who had little expectation they'd ever see Yosemite or Yellowstone or the national parks. For them, the Hudson was their environment. It was their bathing beaches, their fishing holes, their swimming holes. It was their recreation. It was their livelihood. It was their property value. In 1966, Penn Central Railroad began vomiting oil from a 4.5-foot pipe in the Croton Harmon rail yard, and that oil went up the river on the tides, blackened the beaches. It made the shad taste of diesel so that they couldn't be sold to the Fulton Fish Market in New York City. And all the people in Crotonville came together in a little building, the only public building in the town, which was the American Legion Hall. It was a very patriotic community. Crotonville, New York, had the highest mortality rate during World War II of any community in our country. Virtually the entire male population joined the Marines the day after Pearl Harbor. So, almost all of the original founders of Waterkeeper were former Marines. They were combat veterans from World War II in Korea. These weren't radicals. They weren't militants. They were people whose patriotism was rooted in the bedrock of our country. But that night, they started talking about violence because they saw something that they thought they owned, which was the abundance of these fisheries and the purity of the Hudson's waters, and it was being robbed from them by large corporate entities over whom they had no control. And they'd been to the government agencies that are supposed to protect Americans from pollution, to the Corps of Engineers, the Conservation Department, the Coast Guard, and they were given the bum's rush.
So there was a Conservation Department back then.
There was. It's now called DC. It used to be called the State Conservation Department. But they went to the Corps of Engineers office, Rachel, in New York City on 20 occasions. The head of the president of the Fishermen's Association, his name, Richie Garrett, he was a combat veteran Marine from Korea, and he went on 20 separate occasions begging the court colonel to do his job and shut down the Penn Central pipe. And finally, the colonel told him in exasperation, "These are important people." Speaking of the Penn Central Board of Directors, the polluters. And he said, "We can't treat them that way. In other words, we can't force these important people to comply with the law." So by this evening, in March of 1966, virtually everybody in Crotonville had come to the conclusion that government was in cahoots with the polluters, and the only way that they were going to reclaim the river for themselves is if they confronted the polluters directly. And somebody suggested that they put a match to the oil slick coming out of the Penn Central pipe and burn up the pipe. Somebody else said that they should roll a mattress up and jam it up the pipe and flood the rail yard with its own waste. Somebody else said they should float a raft of dynamite into the intake of the Indian Point power plant, which at that time was killing a million fish a day on its intake screens and taking food off their family tables. And then a guy stood up who was a famous fisherman, fly fisherman, and had come to that meeting. It was another Marine. He was the outdoor editor of Sports Illustrated magazine, and his name was Bob Boyle, and he was one of the gurus of dry fly tying in this country. And he, 2 years before, he had written an article in Sports Illustrated about angling in the Hudson. And when he was researching that article, he had discovered an ancient navigational statute called the 1888 Rivers and Harbors Act. And that statute said it was illegal to pollute any waterway in the United States. You had to pay a big penalty if you got caught. But also there was a bounty provision that said that anybody who turned in the polluter got to keep half the fine. And he had actually sent a copy of this law over to the lawyers at Time magazine, which owned Sports Illustrated. He said, "Is this still good law?" And they sent him a memo back saying, "In 80 years, it's never been enforced, but it's still on the books. It's good law." And that evening, when all of these men and women, 300 people, were in that American Legion Hall talking about violence, he stood up in front of them and he said, "We shouldn't be talking about breaking the law. We should be talking about enforcing it." And they resolved that night that they were going to start a group that later became Riverkeeper. And they would go out and track down and prosecute every polluter on the Hudson. 18 months later, they shut down the Penn Central pipe. They kept $2,000, which was a huge amount of money in Crotonville in 1968. They used the money to go after Siba Geigy, Tuck Tape, Standard Brands, American Cyanamid, the biggest corporations in America. In 1973, they collected $200,000 from Anaconda Wire and Cable for dumping toxics at Hastings, New York. They used the money to construct a boat. They used bounty money to hire me as their attorney in 1983. They hired a full-time riverkeeper, a former commercial fisherman named John Cronin. And since then, we've brought 500 lawsuits. The Hudson today, as a result of our work, is the richest waterway in the North Atlantic.
What do you mean by the richest?
I mean that it produces more pounds of fish per acre, more biomass per gallon, and any waterway in the Atlantic Ocean north of the equator. It's the last major river system left in the Atlantic Ocean that still has strong spawning stocks of all of its historical species of migratory fish. So it's Noah's Ark. It's a species warehouse. It's the last refuge for many of these animals that are going extinct elsewhere. And the restoration of the Hudson inspired the creation now of 294 keepers on waterways all across the world.
And you tell this story beginning with a group of blue-collar folks who made their living and enjoyed recreation on the water and on those beaches. And so much of the work that you've done as an environmental attorney pivots on the issue of environmental justice. Are those issues ever separable, environmental advocacy and environmental justice, or are they always going to be entwined?
They're always entwined, at least in my experience. If you look around, in this state included, the costs of environmental injury always fall disproportionately on the backs of poor communities and minority communities. 4 out of every 5 toxic waste dumps in America is in a black neighborhood. The largest toxic waste dump in the country is Emile, Alabama, which is 85% black. The highest concentration of toxic waste dumps in America is the south side of Chicago. In Los Angeles, where I moved recently, the most contaminated zip code in all of California is East LA, which is a poor black neighborhood. here in North Carolina, 8 of the biggest toxic waste dumps, the coal ash ponds that are used by Duke Energy, are in black neighborhoods. So, and you can go on and on with those examples, but this is a phenomenon that we see everywhere, that democracy and the environment are intertwined, and justice and the environment are also intertwined.
We've spent the last 5 weeks or so on this show talking about concentrated animal feeding operations, hog production and poultry production. It's an important part of the economic engine, at least in the agricultural sector in this state. And we've talked about the claims of negative impacts on local waterways. There is a complaint, a Title VI complaint, filed against the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. Is that something that the Waterkeeper Alliance is involved in?
Yes. And, you know, we've been involved in this issue. We have 14 water keepers, river keepers here in North Carolina, and we have an Air Force that of 22 planes that patrols the hog farms constantly. It takes pictures. We've taken tens of thousands of pictures from the air looking at these hog operations, literally breaking the law in front of us, spraying their spray fields during rainy days, spraying into rivers, into streams, polluting the waterways of North Carolina, which were once the richest waterways in the world. But if you look in Duplin County, Bladen County, where most of these and all of eastern North Carolina, and particularly southeastern North Carolina, where these hog farms are located, it's almost always in communities that don't have the political power, that lack the political power to keep them moving out.
And we're going to talk more about CAFOs when we come back from this short break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Robert Kennedy Jr., president of the Waterkeeper Alliance, is our guest today. After this short break, we'll open the phone lines. You can call us today at 910-343-1138 or send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Waterkeeper Alliance President Robert Kennedy Jr. is with us today. We're talking about the international organization's agenda for this year's convention, what he sees as the most urgent environmental issues facing the planet. And he's answering your questions. The phone lines are now open. You can reach us today at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And before we went to break, we were talking about CAFOs. And Mr. Kennedy, you were talking about some of the resources that you provide to the local river keepers to do surveillance, aerial surveillance of hog and poultry facilities. And you were talking about how actually you believe that these facilities pollute nearby waterways.
The industry was really invented here in North Carolina back in the 80s. A state legislator named Wendell Murphy took a look at what three chicken barons had done, Frank Perdue, Don Tyson, and Bo Pilgrim, who over the previous 15 years had devised a new way of raising chickens, and they had put 1 million independent chicken farmers out of business in this country, and had so that we had reached the state at that point where there were virtually no independent fryer broiler egg producers in America, and they had shifted chicken production to a factory-like atmosphere where chickens were shoehorned, 1 million chickens shoehorned into a single facility and raised in what they call battery cages, where they couldn't stand up or turn around, and where they were dosed with antibiotics and hormones that caused them to literally lay their guts out over a short, miserable life. And Wendell Murphy looked at that model and said, I can do the same thing with hogs. And he passed 28 laws in the state of North Carolina that made it almost impossible to sue a hog factory, and gave huge subsidies to this new industry. And he devised a special warehouse called the Murphy 1100. He left the legislature. He went into business with Smithfield, persuaded them to build the biggest slaughterhouse in the world. In Bladen County, it slaughters 30,000 hogs a day. And within 10 years, they had put out of business virtually every hog farmer in the state of North Carolina. They dropped the price of pork from 65 cents to 5 cents a pound. And it cost a farmer about 32 cents a pound to raise that pig to kill weight. So literally, no hog farmer could stay in business unless he signed a contract with Murphy. And it was the end of family farming for hogs in the state, but also the beginning of this huge pollution source. There's now more people, more hogs in eastern North Carolina than there are people. There's 10 million hogs in the eastern part of the state on 2,200 factories. And
there's been an evolution, though, of the practices in the industry since then. There's a moratorium on any more hog farms that can have lagoons. There's a moratorium on that kind of concentrated animal feeding operation. And there are strict regulations in place over how the waste that comes out of these facilities can be used.
Well, yeah, I mean, you make a good point that there's a moratorium, but we had, by the time we put the moratorium in place, we had already reached kind of market saturation. So nobody really wanted to see more hog farms, including the industry. When Wendell Murphy started production, there was about 28,000 independent hog producers in the state, and now there are virtually none. And instead, you have 2,200 factories, which are mainly about 80% of them are owned by two companies. So you have exactly what Thomas Jefferson feared, which was the takeover of the landscape by a few large corporations, which is what he said was the thing that distinguished America from Europe. You know, in Europe, the land was all owned by a couple of large by a handful of large aristocracy, and today you have a corporate kleptocracy in America that now controls, you know, 80% of the land base of, you know, at least as in terms of hog production in the entire state of North Carolina. Jefferson thought that American democracy could only survive if it was rooted in tens of thousands of independent freeholds owned by family farmers, each control of their own land, and each with a vested interest in our system. And we've lost that now. And what was developed here in North Carolina, because it drove down the price of hogs, has metastasized to the entire country and infected the entire industry. And the reason it drives down costs is not because of greater efficiencies. It's because of the political power to pollute, to dump their waste into our landscapes without any kind of cost being imposed, but to externalize their costs, and also to take advantage of huge federal subsidies in the corn industry, which independent farmers could not do.
When you're talking about externalizing costs, that's an environmental advocacy term that's used to mean what? How does a company do that?
In a true free market economy, an actor in the marketplace, a producer of a product, would have to pay the full cost of getting his product to market. But what polluters do is they, and that includes, of course, the cost of cleaning up after yourself, which is a lesson we were all supposed to learn in kindergarten. But what polluters do is they force the public to pay those costs by polluting. So we shoulder the costs, you know, through damaged health care, through damaged environment, through diminished lives, through diminished property values when somebody pollutes. What environmental laws are intended to do is to restore free market capitalism by forcing polluters to internalize the cost, to pay the true cost of bringing their product to market.
So you've compared this business model to a cancer that has metastasized across the country. Are there any CAFOs that are doing it right? Are there any CAFOs that could be considered sustainable models of operation? Or
I would say to you that, yeah, there is a sustainable model, and it's called farming. You know, we were producing in 1915, we were producing more hogs in this country than we're producing today. Oh, we were producing them in a sustainable way. And we were, and the money that was coming from those hogs was going to tens of thousands of American families, and it was supporting communities, and it was enriching communities.
And the industry would argue today that there are plenty of farm families that are licensed by the big producers, and the big producers own, I guess, a lot of they own the animals, and they pay for the production. The farmer owns the land, but they call them family farmers.
Yeah, they call them that, but they're really just indentured servants on their own property. They're what the Russians used to call serfs. A family farmer is somebody who makes independent decisions over their own farms. And the way, here's, Rachel, here's how the model works. The company goes to somebody, a farmer, who is about to collapse because the price of hogs is 5 cents, and it costs him 32 cents to raise the hog. And the company, Smithfield or Murphy, will go to that farmer and say, look, you're about to lose everything, but we're going to give you a way out. You sign this contract, and here's what it's going to say. You build one of our facilities on your property. It's going to cost you $200,000, so we need you to mortgage your house and your farm to build this hog plant. And we're going to provide you with the feed. We're going to provide you with the animals. You raise them for 60 days and give them back to us. But you're going to own the waste. And we don't want to know what you're going to do with it. And we're not going to give you enough money to dispose of it legally. And so that farmer, and by the way, if you decide you don't want to deal with it, if we drop the price we're paying you next year, what are you going to do? You cannot dismantle your facility. Your home and your farm no longer have any value except as one of our hog farms, and nobody will slaughter your animals if you don't sign a contract with us, because we own the only slaughterhouse. So you now are completely a servant or a slave to us and to our whims, and your entire future is in our hands. You no longer have any say over what you're going to do with your property, and your property has no value to anybody except us.
You're listening to Coastline. Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., president of the Waterkeeper Alliance and chief prosecuting attorney for the Hudson River Keeper, is here today. He'll take your questions. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we talk about sustainable food production, that being an important puzzle for protecting the waterways, especially in North Carolina, do you think that market-based forces are starting to pick up that fight? Are consumers demanding more sustainably produced goods? Are they showing that they're willing to pay more for those products when they're considered to be sustainably produced?
Well, here's the facts about that. There's a big consumer movement towards more sustainable agriculture and healthier agriculture. People, I once saw the marketing data from Procter & Gamble. I was on a board with the CEO of Procter & Gamble, and he showed me this very interesting marketing data, which Procter & Gamble has extensive marketing data for consumer attitudes going back almost 100 years. And he showed that there's about 5% of the population that will pay more for a product because that product has a social benefit. But that's it. That's the cap.
When was that research done?
That research was done. It's consistent over hundreds of over 100 years, over a century. People will pay more if there's a health benefit for them. So, and that, I think, is the key here, is that people are beginning to understand that factory-raised hogs are not good for you. It's not good meat. It doesn't taste well as well. It's laced in many cases with hormones, with in the case of poultry, with arsenic, and with antibiotics that are dangerous not only for the whole society but for you as a consumer. And when people and so it's like it goes to the quality of the product and what you're getting for it. And people will, there, large portions of the population will pay more for product, will pay a premium for products that they consider healthy or better.
You recently performed a ribbon cutting ceremony for what you are calling the largest nutrient recovery facility in the world. This took place in Chicago, I think.
Yes.
And just explain, first of all, why the launch of this plant meant so much to you and what game you think it will change.
In addition to doing environmental advocacy, I also do environmental. I'm deeply involved in the environmental innovation and energy and environmental innovation space. So I've been a partner for many years on the biggest venture, green tech venture capital firm in the country, and I'm involved with a number of companies that are trying to change the change production models to make them more energy efficient and to make them greener. And many of these are in the water space. And this company with you're talking about, Ostara, which is a company that removes phosphorus from the stream of a sewage treatment plant and turns it into a very valuable fertilizer that can then be marketed around the country. And it's important because phosphorus is normally, like here in North Carolina, every farm needs phosphorus fertilizer. That phosphorus is coming from Morocco or from Florida. It's cracked out of the rock. It's sent across the ocean. It's very carbon-intensive process, and it's expensive. And then the first time it rains, most of that phosphorus, 80% of it will wash off into the local stream. It grows plants when it's put on land. When it puts in water, it grows aquatic plants, which are algae, and that destroys the ecosystem. So this is a way of mining phosphorus locally. Through every sewage treatment plant is dumping phosphorus. We can remove that phosphorus. We turn it into a pelletized fertilizer, and that fertilizer, that particular fertilizer, will not dissolve in water, so it will never run off. It only dissolves when the plant roots release certain kinds of acids that when they want to uptake more phosphorus. And so it will wait there for years, literally, and feed the plant. So it's a much more efficient system. It's a system that's being widely adopted.
And is this technology?
What we did in Chicago was significant because Chicago is the largest sewage treatment plant on Earth. And the fact that they adopted our technology is a signal to the entire industry that this is now mainstream.
Could that technology be extrapolated to CAFOs, for instance? I mean, that's one of the bigger issues with CAFOs is the runoff, the fact that this gets...
It could be adapted to reduce phosphorus runoff. The problem is that, you know, CAFOs are really getting away with murder because there's no... A CAFO, Rachel... A hog produces 10 times the amount of waste by fecal waste by weight as a human being. So if you have a facility that has 10,000 hogs in it, it's producing as much sewage as a city of 100,000 people. There's one, Smithfield has one plant in Utah, they call it Circle 4, which has a million hogs on it. So it's producing the same amount of waste as New York City every day. Well, there's no difference between hog waste and human waste in terms of its danger to human health. They ought to have a sewage treatment plant that cleans it up. And yet, if they had to build that sewage treatment plant, it would drive the price of hogs up so that they could no longer function in the marketplace. Now, a traditional farmer didn't have to do that. Because a traditional farmer would take the waste from those hogs, spread them on his field, grow corn, and feed the hogs. So it was a closed-loop system, at least theoretically. It was a closed-loop system. But what a CAFO is doing, a CAFO is a factory, and the manure is no longer a valuable byproduct. It is now a waste product that they want to dispose of, just like sewage. And they ought to have to build sewage treatment facilities, but nobody's making them do that because... They have used political clout to escape the discipline of the free market and force the public to pay for their cost of production.
You're listening to Coastline. Robert Kennedy, Jr., president of the Waterkeeper Alliance, is our guest today. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Danielle from Jacksonville, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is a vegan or a vegetarian diet being promoted at all to combat this issue of pollution from, you know, factory farming with animals? Because it doesn't seem that that has been mentioned at all.
Well, that definitely would be a solution if we could persuade every American or most Americans to be vegan or vegetarian. I think they'd probably have a lot better health, and they would, and we'd definitely have a cleaner environment, and we'd have a lot more water, because so much of our water goes into beef, meat, pork, and poultry production. So ultimately, if we could do that, that would be the best thing. Until we get to that point where Americans are willing to adopt those kind of diets, we are in a kind of triage situation where, you know, we can use lawsuits to change behavior of the industry so that there's a lot less production.
Danielle, thanks so much for that call. You're listening to Coastline. We have an email from Matthew who writes, has your agency looked into the relationship between the Eastern North Carolina commercial fishing industry and the NCDMF? I'm not sure what that acronym is, what it represents. It is my understanding North Carolina has more liberal commercial fishing regulations than any other state on the eastern seaboard, despite what the science shows.
I'm hearing the clock.
We can answer it when we come back from the break. Yeah. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a discussion with Robert Kennedy Jr. about his work with the Waterkeeper Alliance and what will be front and center for the organization in the coming year. You have one segment left to ask your question. You can reach us today at 910-343-1138 or coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Robert Kennedy Jr. is here today answering your questions, and we're examining the pollution-based prosperity model juxtaposed against possibly some emerging business interests of his. You can give us a call with your question at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And just before we went to break, we were asked a question about the relationship between the Eastern North Carolina commercial fishing industry and NCDMF.
Which is the Department of Marine Fisheries for North Carolina.
There it is.
There is a, you know, the Department of Marine Fisheries, all of the environmental agencies of North Carolina state government, are what we call captive agencies. They're essentially sock puppets for the industry that they're supposed to regulate, and they represent usually not the public interest, but the interests of the most powerful and the biggest polluters in the state. So unfortunately, there's been a real, wherever you see environmental injury, you're also gonna see a subversion of democracy, and it's particularly acute here in North Carolina, and particularly under the current governor, who is very vocal in his concept that the agencies that are supposed to regulate industry should actually be serving the industry at its lowest level.
If you have a question for Robert Kennedy Jr., you can give us a call today at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org.
Rachel, if I could say one other thing, is that I have a number of companies, but I have one environmental company called ColorZen that has just opened a factory in Mebane, North Carolina. And ColorZen is a company that owns a technique for dyeing cotton without consumptive use of water. So we can produce richer colors, better color fastness, much quicker, using 75% less energy a third of the time, and we can do it without polluting the water. And today, about 20% of the industrial water pollution on Earth is caused by cotton dyeing. And we have the capacity now to revolutionize that industry to stop pollution in the cotton dyeing industry. And it's happening here in North Carolina. North Carolina has, as you know, very, very strong apparel industry. It's the biggest dye house, the biggest mills, like Parkdale, in the country. And they're, that industry is very interested in reducing its carbon imprint and reducing its pollution imprint.
We have Tim from Eastern North Carolina. Welcome to Coastline. Tim, you're on the air.
Thank you, Rachel. Thanks for taking my call. And Mr. Kennedy, we appreciate the work that you do. I just wanted to make a comment. We have a small farm where we raise pork and chicken, and soon we'll be raising beef too. But we pasture raise all of our pork and our chickens, and we literally have people waiting in line to buy this product from us. We use all natural feed. We contract with a couple of grocery stores. We get their produce that they're about to throw away, and we feed that. And I was just wondering what his thoughts were for this farm-to-table movement that we're seeing around the country. We've been fairly successful with it. We've got other small farmers that we associate with that have been successful with it. And I was just wondering what his thoughts were on that farm-to-table movement that we're seeing.
We applaud that, and I think ultimately that's one of the answers, is because that people understand that they're going to get healthier food, they're going to get better quality food, they're going to be supporting local agriculture. As you know, one of the impediments to switching over to organic agriculture is that you need a 5-year period where you can show there was no pesticides or chemical pesticides used on the property, and that's just a daunting impediment for most farmers. The other big impediment is how to market their product, because it is more expensive at the outset, at least, to grow food this way than the food that is being marketed, by Smithfield, et cetera. And they control the chains, they control the supply chains to most of the marketing outfits. And I'd love to know how you are marketing your product.
Tim?
Well, there's local farmers markets. There are several associations that go directly to the restaurants. Feast Down East is one that we're associated with. And there's, again, the local farmers markets. People are looking for naturally raised produce and proteins. And we are not organic, and we do not advertise. We do advertise as non-GMO, which we can verify through the feed that we buy and the way that we feed our chickens and pork. But the word of mouth, church members, friends, I mean, we have some avenues. It's difficult to get it started, but once you do, we're finding that people are coming back. The same thing with eggs. I mean, we have pasture-raised chicken layers, and I can sell every single egg I make. But it's basically word of mouth. It's a lot of work, but it's very rewarding when people come back and want your product again.
Okay, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you so much for your call. And we have Susan from Hampstead. Welcome to Coastline. Susan, you're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, how does the Waterkeeper Alliance partner with other organizations like Nature Conservancy, perhaps, or the World Wildlife Fund to address some of these significant challenges?
Well, like every social movement that's successful, you need a lot of different approaches. And in the environmental movement, you look at the Civil Rights Movement, you have the Black Panther Party on one side, and you have the NAACP and SNCC and Martin Luther King on the other, and they all took different approaches to get to the same place. It's the same thing with the environmental movement. You have Nature Conservancy, which is a land purchasing or land trust organization. You have educational organizations. You have organizations that do legislation like NRDC. The niche that we fill is law enforcement. And the reason that's necessary is because all of our environmental law, we have wonderful environmental laws in this country. If they were enforced, we really wouldn't have that many environmental problems. The problem is none of them are enforced. And the reason they're not enforced is because the capacity for big industrial polluters to capture the regulatory process and disable enforcement. The people, when we wrote these laws after Earth Day 1970, we passed 28 environmental laws after Earth Day 1970. And in almost all of those laws, we anticipated that that industry would be able to disable the regulatory agencies and enforcement agencies. So in almost all of those laws, we included a provision, a unique provision called the citizen suit provision, that says if the government fails to enforce the law and somebody is conducting criminal acts, that any citizen can step into the shoes of the United States attorney and prosecute that polluter in a federal court for penalties and for injunctive relief. And the water keepers utilize those citizen supervisions to enforce the laws when government fails us.
Susan, thank you so much for your call. And we have George from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to take issue with some of the facts that Mr. Kennedy was mentioning. My field is animal nutrition, and I've been independently formulating feed for a variety of feed companies for, as many as 40 years. And I want to say that on this hormone issue, the hormones were experimented with back in the 1930s and 1940s. And since then, hormones have never and are not in use in animal feeds. In spite of what you might read on a label on a Tyson bag at the grocery store that says hormone-free, that's more of a marketing ploy.
George, you're saying that's a meaningless designation.
It's a meaningless designation because hormones have not been used, are not used in any animal feed. Another issue about arsenicals. Arsenicals were a type of antibiotic that was used for growth promotion, much like most of the antibiotics that are used in the animal feed industry. But arsenicals were outlawed by USDA and FDA about 4 years ago, and they are no longer used in the animal industry at all. Regarding phosphorus, the animal industry has done very well in trying to reduce the level of phosphorus across the board in all their animal feeds. The advent of the technology of utilizing enzymes to help digest some of the phosphorus that's bound up in corn and soybeans has been very beneficial, so that the phosphorus that's actually in the feed naturally becomes more available to the animal, and thus has reduced the amount of phosphorus artificially that has to be added. And that's reduced the level of phosphorus in feeds by about one-third across the board, across every species of animal. Anyway, these are just some of the things that I thought we should, facts that we should kind of correct that are going out on the air.
George, thank you so much for your call. Mr. Kennedy.
Yeah, you still have GMOs. You still have widespread use of therapeutic antibiotics, which has all kinds of problems that we didn't talk about, including the creation of superbugs, which the FDA gave a warning about this week. And the overuse of those antibiotics is, you know, should have been outlawed long, long ago. But the food industry and the agriculture industry and the Farm Bureau have been fighting that tooth and nail. It's something that's terrible for the American people, terrible for humanity, and yet we continue to do it. Even if you reduce phosphorus by a third, it's still a huge problem, and we're seeing probably the biggest single pollution issue, or at least arguably in this country, for freshwater systems is phosphorus discharges, and most of those are coming from animals. You know, every animal has phosphorus in it. You know, you're 1.5% phosphorus, every animal is. When you slaughter that animal, that phosphorus is going to go into the environment. When the food still contains large amounts of phosphorus, and the manure from these operations is so vast, the manure output is so vast, that there's no way that even if you did 90% removal of phosphorus, it would still create a huge phosphorus problem.
I want to talk for a second about transitioning to cleaner energy sources. You've been a big champion of this, of course. The New York Times recently published a piece about nuclear energy getting another serious look and this aging fleet of nuclear plants that we have. What is the Waterkeeper Alliance position on nuclear energy? Where is that going? Is that a potentially sustainable energy source? Is that the future of this country?
I would say, you know, Waterkeeper Alliance doesn't have a position on nuclear energy. My own position on nuclear energy is that it'll be great whenever they make it safe and whenever they make it economical. Right now, it is neither of those. And, you know, I believe in free market capitalism. The last nuclear power plant that was built was in Norway. It costs about $14.5 billion per gigawatt to build. You can build a solar plant for about $2.7 billion a gigawatt. So why would you, you know, I mean, we could make energy by burning prime rib if we wanted to, but why would you use the most expensive way to generate energy that you can, you know, that we can, that's out there? There's none of these utilities that will pay for the plant themselves. The only way these plants are ever built is with huge public subsidies. So, you know, in terms of cost, they're just not in the region to make them competitive with other renewables. In terms of safety, the industry will say it's safe. And, you know, my attitude towards that is if you're really safe, then get an insurance policy. That's what everybody else does. But this industry cannot get an insurance policy. And the insurance industry, this isn't a bunch of hippies in tie-dye t-shirts who are saying they're unsafe. It's guys from Wall Street, from AIG, and from the big insurance companies who are saying, you are too dangerous for us to insure. So the industry had to go to Congress in a sleazy legislative maneuver in the middle of the night and get the Price-Anderson Act passed, which absolves them of any liability or of most, virtually all of the liability for nuclear accidents. Well, nobody else has that. And the insurance industry is the ultimate arbiter of risk in this country and anywhere in a capitalist system. And so what I would say is if you're really safe, just get an insurance policy and then we'll all believe you.
The Obama administration recently pulled the Mid-Atlantic region from its plan for offshore drilling for oil and gas, much to the relief of many coastal stakeholders. And this was an issue up and down the East Coast, as you probably know. Do Mid-Atlantic coastal stakeholders have anything to worry about? Are we moving in the right direction from where you sit as president of the Waterkeeper Alliance?
Well, that's that the right front? Direction, clearly. And, you know, the kind of oil and gas that we would be drilling for on the East Coast is expensive. We shouldn't be going after that kind of oil and gas at this point in world history. We should be reducing oil and gas. We should be reducing our use. We should not be building infrastructure, particularly infrastructure that is going to continue to operate for 30 or 50 years. We should be making investments in wind and solar. Today in this country, we use about 1,000 gigawatts of energy at peak demand. It costs about $3 billion a gigawatt to replace that energy with solar or wind. And that's what we should be doing. It's cheaper to build a solar plant today in this country, in almost every state in this country, than to build a gas plant. And we should be focusing our energy on that rather than dinosaur fuels.
Okay, we're going out, but you flirted with running for office a couple of times. Is that in the future for you? Is that something you'd consider?
I think I'll let my kids figure that one out.
That's this edition of Coastline. Robert Kennedy, it's been a pleasure having you on today.
Thank you, Rachel.
And remember, you can now hear Coastline twice a week on Wednesdays and Thursdays at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Our producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it later at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.